Welcome to this special episode of the Danger Close Podcast. Over the next few weeks, I'll be answering listener and viewer questions about the novels in the lead up to the publication of Red Sky Morning, available June 18th, 2024. Will there be spoilers? Absolutely. Be sure and stay tuned after the Q&A to listen to Ray Porter read the prologue. This episode of the Danger Close Podcast is brought to you by Sig Sauer, makers of the pistol that was on my side for every deployment. Thank you to everyone who submitted questions on the social channels for this Q&A Danger Close podcast. They were amazing questions, really fired me up. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to do that. I'm going to kick things off here. This is about the terminal list, and this comes from Instagram at John Kerins, K-E-R-I-N-S. And he asks, what was the inspiration for Reese's bladed weapon of choice, the Winkler Tomahawk? Oh, you mean this Winkler Tomahawk? That's the one. And so I wanted something – I knew the importance of props just growing up as a fan of the genre, a reader, watcher of film and television. And I knew the importance of props, as did Sylvester Stallone, because in the novel First Blood, there isn't a knife. But in the movie First Blood, starring Sylvester Stallone, there is a knife. And it became quite iconic. And knives and then later a bow became associated with that character in all the films going forward. So I knew I didn't want to copy that and just have a blade, maybe just a different blade than Stallone had in the movie First Blood. So I thought, what is a weapon that harkens back to more like an ancient weapon that can be modernized for use today? And also helps develop that character as a student of warfare. And that was the Winkler Tomahawk. And they were carried by different special operations operators over the last 20 years and probably still today, but in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it was very natural for me to choose the Winkler Tomahawk as James Reese's weapon of choice and also as my logo. The next question comes from Jordan McCauley on Instagram, and he asks, did you have a moral debate on how violent to make his wife and daughter's deaths, and how difficult was that to write? This would be one of those spoiler alerts. But for me, I knew it was important to not always describe action or describe violence in the same way. So you can describe it in detail. You can have others talk about something that happened or just lead it up to the reader's or listener's imagination. So for that one, that's essentially what happened. James Reese is outside. The police don't let him in. And most it's described later, but a lot of readers will probably have a different vision of exactly what happened in there, even though it is described later from the essentially the police perspective, like what they found. So there wasn't really a moral debate about it. It was just a different way to describe things. So there are options, and I do that in all the books. I like to mix it up. All right, next question. The Dell Man, also from Instagram. How did you land on the name James Reese? Had you had the name in mind for a while? Any inspirations for it? And he writes, I'm guessing some 007 influence. And surprisingly, not. The name, both names, James and Reese, come from, are personal. So at some point, maybe I'll talk about them, but, not today. And James and Bond wasn't the influence for that first name. But interestingly enough, afterward, because both names come from a personal place, it was only later that someone on social media pointed out James Reese, John Rambo, Jack Reacher, Jack Ryan. So there's something about JR, but that came about very naturally, and I only it was only brought up to me later after the book came out on the social channels. So I thought that was kind of cool that it came about naturally like that. Next one from Hey Justin Herman on Instagram. How old is James Reese in each one of the novels? How much time has passed from the Terminal List to the latest book that's coming out? So that is a very good question. And one I was thinking about from the beginning. So there's a few different examples out there. So the Gabriel Alon series by Daniel Silva, he has aged his character in real time. And those books started over 20 years ago. So the character is a lot older now. So that has to be taken into account as the stories are written. The Bob Lee Swagger character in the Stephen Hunter series, he has also aged in real time. So he's getting up there. He's a Vietnam veteran. So he is up there.
There are a few other examples out there. James Bond is Ian Fleming. What he did, he kept it a little ambiguous about how old is it exactly Bond is, but he's probably between age, let's say 35 and 45. I think more specifically, it's 37 and 42, but he's in that range. And if you go back to the Spencer books, so Robert B. Parker's books, some of you may have watched the series back in the 80s, Spencer for Hire. So in the first book, he was a Korean War veteran. And then as things moved along, he kind of naturally progressed into a Vietnam veteran. And then the series of books is still continuing today after Robert B. Parker's death. So now he has a different background, and readers have just accepted that. So for me and James Reese, what I think I'm going to do, and this can always change, of course, I'm going to age him slowly. So that's how I've decided to go about it, at least at the time of this recording. All right, next one from Chance _ Engelhart. It's been a minute since we've heard from Marco. When are you looping him back into the mix? And yeah, interestingly enough, when I wrote the first novel, I thought many of the characters would be recurring that didn't end up becoming recurring characters, just because it felt forced and it wasn't natural. But I'd love to get back to some of those characters that didn't become recurring characters early on. Marco del Toro is one of them, who is actually based on someone who I know. So we'll see. All right. Now moving on to X. And this is from Brendan Joyce. All right. While it is obvious that your career helped to forge the character of James Reese, I wanted to know if his hatred of mayonnaise is molded from your own distaste for the egg and oil emulsion loved by many. Oh, disgusting. Yeah. Mayonnaise. So gross. Same thing with sour cream. Just not my thing. Ugh. You can't even read that without getting. Anyway, apologize to all the mayonnaise lovers out there, but disgusting. Also, many nods to Magnum PI in the last book were noted. Awesome. There are nods to Magnum in each one of the novels, and some are obvious and some are not so obvious, but I like to at least incorporate something in each of the novels from Magnum, because it was such an important show to me growing up, and such an influence, and one of the first shows to portray Vietnam veterans in not a negative light. So dealing with post-traumatic stress and those bonds of people who had been in battle together. So it was really a groundbreaking show for its time and very influential on me. So there's something from a little nod to Magnum in every book. All right. Also from X here, this is K Mink _24. When you envisioned James Reese, did you think it would be a long-term character similar to Mitch Rapp, or did you envision James Reese with a story to tell and then move on to the next protagonist? I always envisioned him as a long-term character and always a series of books. But in the first novel, what's so great, if you're a reader or listener and there's not another book out yet, you're not sure. You don't know. You don't know if he's going to make it to the end of the book. So that was really fun, and you can only really do it with a first novel. So that was so I was very aware of that as I started writing and wrote the first book. All right. This is also from X, from H Wooden 22. Was The Terminal List the name you always had in mind for the series, or did you have a different name for it? Terminal List was always the title from the very beginning, but interestingly enough, I never said it out loud, because as I was writing it, I was just viewing it. So The Terminal List, and it looked great. It spoke obviously to the story, to the list, and to what is happening to the character as well. So there's a couple different meanings. I like all my titles to have at least dual meanings, sometimes multiple meanings. So that was always the name of the book from the very beginning. That's not the case with all of them, though. So True Believer was always the name of True Believer. Savage Son was not. And I'll keep what the actual title was from the beginning to myself, because I might use it again some other time. The Devil's Hand was always the title of that book. In the Blood was always the title of that one. Only the Dead was always the title of that one. And the latest book, though, Red Sky Morning, had a different title in the beginning, and then, which I also might use another time, but early on it switched over to Red Sky Morning, which I love that title. So I put a lot of thought into my titles, and I do like them to have multiple meanings. I don't like this to grab something up there, to throw something up there that, that doesn't really have a deeper meaning. So, so I do put a lot of thought into the titles, and I love coming up with them. All right. Next one. This is also from X at Scott McKenna 18. Where did the inspiration for Ben come from? Was he a teammate or a mix of different people you knew? So he was, I'd say he was kind of a mix. And I think I'll probably leave that one there. But interesting, also interesting about that character is I think that the show did a much better job of developing that character. And of course, what Taylor brought to the role. But even on the page, when the writer's room got to that character, that is one that I wish I'd thought of some of the things that the writer's room did and had incorporated those into the novel. So that's one of the characters that I think, was just portrayed so much better in the show than in the book. All right. This one right here at C. Finklea, F-I-N-K-L-E-A. And this is also from X. What was your writing schedule like? I know you say a lot of late nights and early mornings, but I'm curious as to what you tried to get done each day. Additionally, what fears or nerves did you have as you wrote? So for the first one, and it's actually continued to this day, a lot of late nights, because that's when my family is asleep. That's when the phone's not buzzing. That's when emails aren't coming in. That's when there are no phone calls. So it just seems like late at night from 10 to, let's say, 3 in the morning, probably. Those are the hours when I've been most productive on the novels. I'm trying to switch that up because I don't think it's a healthy long-term way to go, especially if you're still getting up early to get kids to school and all that sort of thing. But for all the novels, really, to date, those hours are the ones that I do the most writing. I still try to write during the day, turn off the phone, computer in a different room. I have a computer that I write on that's only for writing and nothing else. And so that's the one that I'll have in front of me. Phone's in the other room, computer in the other room, and go to the quietest place that I can find. So what I really need is uninterrupted time. So that's really what I'm looking for, as those interruptions are what get me. And I don't know if that's how it is with all writers, but that's how it is for me. So I have a place in the house now that's quieter than other places, but it's the most quiet when everyone else is asleep. So, it's really about uninterrupted writing time. And, fears or nerves? I didn't really have fears or nerves. And I guess that's because I knew I wanted to be an author from such an early age. And I guess maybe in the back of your mind, there's a little sliver of just wonder, but it's more like curiosity and wonder rather than fear or nerves, if that makes sense. So it's you're curious if anyone's going to read this. You're curious if you're ever going to get it published, or even get an agent to read it, or a publisher to read it, or an editor to read it, or anyone other than your mom and dad to read it, I guess. So, but not really fears or nerves. All right, next one. This is also from X at Bad Browns Jersey. Okay. One of my favorite recurring subjects in your books is Reese's history with rugby. Did you play rugby? If so, where and when and for how long? Yeah, I wanted to have James Reese and Rafe Hastings have time together before the military on a team. And so rugby for me, I hadn't seen it really explored in other books. You have Mitch Rapp, who played lacrosse and then did Ironman triathlons. But rugby is I just love rugby. And I've always loved it since I was a little kid. But I didn't play it really growing up, other than just throwing it around, not really knowing what we were doing. And then I started playing it way too late in life. And I started playing when I got to Germany, and I had a very, I did a staff job for about 9 months, and staff jobs are not for me. I'm very lucky that I went through most of my time in the SEAL teams, never having to really do one. And I got back to the teams as soon as I could. But while I was over there in Germany, maybe to replace the feelings that you had on a SEAL team, I started playing at a college, and, it was awesome. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. So that's where that comes from. And I love watching it, and you can play it all over the world. Of course, there's sevens out there, and it's just a great international sport. So that's where that came from. And here we go to Facebook. This is Curtis Lowe. And he asks, how did you decide what scenes would be included in the Amazon series from the book? So that first one anyway for the Terminalist, and it's changed now for the Terminalist, Dark Wolf, and for True Believer. But for the Terminalist, that was my introduction to Hollywood, my introduction to screenwriting, my introduction to a writer's room, and to that whole process of bringing something to life or adapting something to film. And I went into it knowing that things were going to change. And my example for that, going back to my experience, was reading First Blood, which was written 1972 by David Morrell. Very different from the film adaptation in the early 80s starring Sylvester Stallone. Both fantastic, though. So I knew that it was going to change, and now there are more constraints. So let's say, so the first series, we have 8-hour-ish long episodes. So that's a constraint right there. There's budgetary constraints. There are, you have to think about how many characters and how many characters that an audience can keep track of and how they're introduced and what their backstory is. And then how do they get into moving the story forward? So there's a lot of factors involved in adapting something for film that you don't have to worry about at all. There are no constraints on me as an author. And I didn't know going into it if that was going to be the case. I didn't know if Simon & Schuster would say things like, hey, maybe you should lay off a little bit on this, or hey, what do you think about incorporating this? I get zero input from Simon & Schuster on things like that. I have 100% creative control. I've never felt any pressure to do anything from Simon & Schuster. So that's all me, which I love, because if something doesn't work, well, that's all on me. And the screenwriting process, much more collaborative. So it wasn't really that I was deciding what was going to be in and what wasn't. It's a writer's room, a team of people coming together using the novel as essentially source material for this story that I knew was going to change. And then for me, I was learning. So I was just watching kind of how this happened, advising throughout the whole process. And this time for Terminalist, Dark Wolf, totally different, much more involved in everything from casting to storyline. And I'm creating it with the showrunner of the first series, David DiGilio. So it's a different experience this time. The Terminalist was my time to learn, essentially, and also prove how I could add value to the production, because it's all about making the best show that we possibly can. But that was essentially my, I guess my master's degree, or maybe a PhD, who knows? It was a foundation from which now to move forward. So there wasn't really of deciding what scenes were going to be in the book. It was more taking the themes of the book and then adapting that to film.
The BCM Raider modular rail for AR rifles is built using a double wall extrusion, creating one of the most rigid free-floating platforms in its weight class. Its unique architecture balances weight, rigidity, and capability, translating to a more consistent zero retention with handguard-mounted electro-optics and lasers. BCM Raider offers Picatinny rails and features either M-Lock or Key-Mod interfaces at 3, 6, and 9 o'clock for the placement of additional enabling accessories. A series of ports have also been positioned to enable pass-throughs for securing vital equipment. Go to BravoCompanyUSA.com and get yours today. Thank you to Bravo Company Manufacturing for your support of military law enforcement and the Danger Close podcast.
Next one here, and this is also from Facebook, from Chad Gibbs. Let's see. He says, now that you have written 7 books in the James Reese series, is there anything that you would go back and change in the first book? Oh, man, that is a good question. And I don't think about that too much, because I can't go back and change anything in the first book. I go back to the novels because I don't yet have a Bible where I can remember where someone went to college or what color someone's eyes were or hair was or something like that. So I have to go back and look. And as I do that, I do see passages that I've written before, and I know that I can always improve. So you can hold on to something forever and make it better by a percentage. But for new authors out there, this is something that I tell people, is that get it to that point where it's as good as you can possibly make it. And if you kept working on it for years and years and years, it would get better by a degree. And that's the point, you know, that it's time to get it to an agent, time to get it to a publisher, time to get it out there. You want to get it to that stage where it's as good as you can possibly make it. So I'm sure there are things that I could go back and change in the novels, but I think they would be relatively minor in most cases. I have to think about that one a little more, but really all my bandwidth goes into the current project and making it better than the last project, than the last book. So that's always my goal. All right. This one's from Matt Smith, also from Facebook. Always a huge fan and love of your love for weaponcraft and being so meticulous in the details of the weapons and gear that Reese uses. My question is, if this universe was set in the late 70s or early 80s, instead of modern day, what do you believe his EDC or go-to gear, weapons, vehicle, etc. would look like? Oh, man, I love that question. But more so because today, everything that I write, I have to think about, okay, everyone has cell phones. Does this character have a cell phone? Are there video cameras everywhere? Is there a GPS in the vehicle, GPS in the mobile device, and all of those different things? Communication, so much different than it was back in, let's say, the 70s and 80s. No one has to run looking for a payphone. And once you got to that payphone, getting a quarter or remembering a calling card number or anything like that. So it is a very different time in which to write. So of course the gear would be different. The vehicle might be an earlier Land Cruiser, might be an FJ40, maybe even earlier, but, or maybe an International Scout, because if I'm writing back then, Without Remorse hadn't come out yet. And that's, John Clark uses an International Scout in that. And I loved International Scouts growing up because they were so different and you didn't see them, in the 80s all over the place. So that was a really cool vehicle. So it might have been a Scout. Certainly could have been a Wagoneer, but back then that might have been a little too modern even. So I like kind of the more classic type stuff. So I might go back to the 60s for something, maybe a Jeep, maybe a Range Rover Land Rover. So anyway, things would definitely change. Pistol wise, that is a very good question. Rifle wise, there sure would have been some differences, but that is a very good question. Probably a 1911 back then in the 70s, early 80s. That's what I'm thinking anyway right now. So probably still a Tomahawk, blades of some sort, yeah, I love that question. I'm going to think about it a little more as well. So that was go-to weapons, gear, vehicle. Yep. But probably 1911, probably leather holster, probably a 1911 that's been worked on, obviously by somebody, and then a classic vehicle for the day. So something from the 50s and 60s. All right. Facebook, Joseph Mellon. In the book, Reese listens to his wife's MP3 player and playlist. Did you ever have a playlist in mind when writing? If so, what songs would you include for Lauren's list and James's list? So I did have a song in mind. So there's a man going around taking names, Johnny Cash. So actually the first edition of the book that I sent to Simon & Schuster, each part of the book had a line from that song. And I think they didn't make it into the book. They might now, but I think you have to pay for those. So I don't think Simon & Schuster was going to go to the Johnny Cash estate and pay to use those, I guess. So those all came out of the different parts of the terminal list. But from that song, that kind of set the tone for what was happening in each of the parts of the terminal list. So I had that in mind. And then the MP3 player playlist was essentially my wife's. So, all right. Gavin Dodd. Stories with revenge themes are some of my favorite. Did these types of books, movies influence you to include a theme of revenge in the terminal list? Absolutely. So some of my favorite movies and books have that theme, whether it's the primary theme or not, that it's in there. I always liked that being in there in the books that I read growing up and the movies that I watched. I think there's a reason why there's so many Death Wish movies, and that's because it resonates. And in movies and books, you can do things, or you can watch a character do things, or you can have that experience where in real life you really can't, cause you go to prison. So I think it really has resonated with people from the beginning of time. So that was very important to me in kicking off this series, is to write and have a theme that was going to be as hard hitting, as visceral and as primal as I could right out of the gate. So that theme of revenge was the one, because what I did is I wrote down all these different ideas and spread them out on a table, very similar to this one. And then I chose the idea that I thought was going to be the most primal and most visceral and the most hard hitting. So that's how I ended up with that theme of revenge without constraint. All right. This is also from Facebook, Eric Pearson. At what age did you know you wanted to be an author? Did you write or journal as a kid, young man, or take any formal writing classes? And so I wanted to be an author very early on, wanted to serve my country in uniform for as long as I can remember, and specifically as a SEAL, as soon as I found out what SEALs were when I was in second grade. But author, I think, probably came either fifth or sixth grade, certainly by sixth grade. I knew that I wanted to be an author one day. I also knew that I wanted to be a SEAL first, and then an author, and write the same kind of books that I was reading back then in sixth grade. So sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth grade, I'm reading David Morrell's Brotherhood of the Rose, Fraternity of the Stone, League of Might, Night and Fog. I'm reading books by J.C. Pollock, by Mark Olden, Tom Clancy, all these masters of the genre. So, and I'm reading them through the eye of someone who is 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, who really hasn't built up some of maybe the, I don't know, cynicism that you get as you grow older. It was just the magic of those pages, and I have such wonderful memories of reading all those books. So I knew what I wanted to do very early on. So certainly by sixth grade, as I'm reading books by the masters. And let's see, Jeff Thorne. Oh, and did I take any formal writing classes? No. And it's, I think it's similar to Quentin Tarantino never going to film school and being a fan of film for his entire life. And for me, I've been a reader my entire life, a fan of this genre. I know the history of this genre, but not from an academic perspective, more from the fan perspective. So no formal writing classes. Jeff Thorne, will any of the new cast members be on Danger Close anytime soon? We shall see. We shall see. I did a podcast series for The Terminalist where I talked to the showrunner, David DiGilio, and my friend from the SEAL teams, Jared Shaw, who gave Chris Pratt the book and is the reason that there is a series. So probably do something similar for The Terminalist, Dark Wolf, and True Believer as well, because it's so much fun to go back after it's done and bring everybody together and talk about it. All right, Alex Cheng. How closely are some of the main characters based on real people you knew? And well, some are based on, it's all based on life experience. So there's probably people in the books that are based on people that I've run across in my life who I don't even realize I've incorporated into some of these characters. And some, for those reading closely, or you don't even really have to read too closely, there are some people in the books that may be inspired by maybe people in the news, politicians and people like that, generals, admirals, perhaps. All right, Craig Bostick. Why did you pick a Kiowa warrior pilot to highlight? I have 5,000 hours in them, and we get overlooked by history. I just love that helicopter. And I think it was in Iraq 2004-05 time frame. I had some experience with that aircraft, and so just wanted to bring it in to the book. It's not one of the normal, you're right, it's not one of the normal helicopters that you typically read about in thrillers. So I just wanted to highlight it because of a personal experience that I had with that airframe in 2004-2005. All right, James Garrett, have you seen or heard of the or to pin the intestines overhead and walk around the pole move, or did you think that up? Impressive. Thank you. I think I first found out about it by studying the Shining Path guerrilla movement in Peru. So particularly in the 80s and 90s, somewhere along the line, I think I'd read about it, and then I sat down and talked to, while I was still in the SEAL teams, near the end, getting out, writing the book, talked to somebody, and wasn't specifically even interviewing them or anything, just having lunch with someone who was an intelligence officer, in the Reagan years. And somehow it came up in conversation. So I asked a few more questions about it and then studied it a little more and found out that it was used in, a few different indigenous peoples type of, warfare as torture, or set an example. And then it was kind of brought back by the Shining Path guerrilla movement, maybe in the 70s, but for sure in the 80s and early 90s. So that's where that came from. So I can't take credit for thinking it up, but it's been around for a long, long time. And it's, yeah, pretty brutal. And that's it for the Terminalist. Thank you to everyone who sent in questions. This was awesome. I sincerely appreciate you taking the time to do this. Next week, we'll be talking about True Believer. I'll be answering those questions. And now you can stay tuned to go into a reading of the prologue by Ray Porter. Be sure to like and subscribe and follow along at Jack Carr USA on the social channels. OfficialJackCarr.com is the website. Go to shop in the upper right-hand corner for the merch. And see you next week with True Believer. The Terminal List, a novel of revenge without constraint. The first novel in the James Reese Terminal List series.
Prologue. It didn't take a tactical genius to pick the spot. Humans are creatures of habit, and some were more religious about it than others. Accountants, it seemed, were practically monastic in their routines. From June 1st to November 1st of every year, Marcus Boykin lived in his mountain house in Star Valley Ranch, Wyoming. Star Valley sounded far more appealing to the East and West Coast real estate buyers than its previous name of Starvation Valley. It was an enclave of wealthy outsiders in otherwise rural western Wyoming, stuck into the mountainside like a well-manicured finger of civilization, full of multi-million-dollar homes in a part of the world otherwise populated by ranchers and cowboys. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, Boykin rose early and climbed into his silver Mercedes G550 SUV to drive the 50 miles to the relative metropolis of Jackson. With a summertime population of bankers and hedge fund managers that would rival the Hamptons, it was the only place within hours where he could eat a gourmet meal with an $800 bottle of wine. In Jackson, he could sip lattes and read the Wall Street Journal in the company of fellow seasonal residents from New York, Greenwich, Boston, and Los Angeles. 3 days a week, he could connect with real people in person, instead of waiting impatiently for his friends to comment on his Facebook posts. Dinners at Rendezvous Bistro were far tastier, and the conversation more stimulating than his usual meal alone on the deck, no matter how spectacular the view. U.S. 89 runs north and south through the steep valley that straddles the line between Wyoming and Idaho. Irrigated hayfields near the roadway lie in the shadows of the rugged 10,000-foot peaks to the east, and more gentle hills to the west. Just north of the tiny town of Alpine, the route to Jackson turns east along the Snake River and winds into the mountains of the Bridger-Teton National Forest. At this point in the journey, the jagged ridgelines of the Tetons run nearly to the roadside, like towering cruise ships moored alongside an asphalt pier. 10 feet from the well-maintained road was terrain as rugged as nearly anywhere in the lower 48. The home of trophy mule deer and giant elk, as well as plenty of black bears and the occasional moose. Having never touched a gun or hunted in his life, it would never occur to Boykin that September 15th, the opening day of deer season in Wyoming's Region G, fell on a Monday that year. James Reese had hiked in the previous afternoon from a trailhead on the opposite side of the mountain from the U.S. highway. The trail began near the road as the crow flies, but it was many miles away by vehicle. The vistas of the highway were as close to the remote backcountry as most seasonal residents like Boykin ventured. Though it was only a few hours' hike from his truck, Reese may as well have walked in from a different world. He wore a light pack with a nylon rifle scabbard strapped to the side, high-performance digital camo hunting clothing from Sitka, and the Salomon hiking boots he had worn on countless operations around the world. Walking through the Wyoming backcountry in the traditional sniper's woolly ghillie suit and heavyweight rifle, he would stick out like a man wandering the mountains in a tuxedo. But clad in the garb of a hunter, he was as invisible as a guy in a blue blazer at the airport. The anonymous tip that he'd called in about the moose poachers just south of Jackson would probably occupy every game department cop in the region. But in the unlikely event that he ran into someone of authority, the hunting license and deer tag in his pocket would verify him as just another hunter out looking for muleys on the busiest day of the year. He could have hiked in at night with a headlamp or brought along his night vision, but he wanted to get into his spot before dark. No sense twisting an ankle, or worse, in this rough country, and he was anxious to get started. He had studied the topography on maps and satellite imagery hundreds of times, but he'd still hiked the route 2 days earlier to ensure that it looked the same on the ground as it did from the air. The country was steep and high. It didn't matter how well you were conditioned at sea level. 8,000 feet was still 8,000 feet. He stopped to catch his breath and guzzle water from the hose clipped to his shoulder strap. His legs burned and his lungs were starved for oxygen. His base layer was covered in sweat despite temperatures in the 50s, so he zipped his top down to let some of his body heat escape. He wasn't in a rush, but he moved with purpose. It certainly wasn't the first time he had pushed himself up a mountain to a target. His perch was just as he'd left it, a small, U-shaped slot eroded into the mountainside that could only be accessed from the front. There was very little chance of a hunter or game warden wandering up on his six while he was in position, and he'd have a clear view of anyone approaching from the front long before they reached his hide site. The spot overlooked a saddle of highway that ran between two steep hills. His position was near the top of the second hill if you were driving toward Jackson. Like a cave without a roof, the spot would protect him from the prying eyes of hunters glassing for deer the afternoon before the season opened, and would keep him out of the wind as the temperature dropped into the low 30s overnight. He pulled his rifle out of the scabbard and laid his pack down just short of the mouth of the slot, so his muzzle would not be visible from below. The rifle was an Eccles Legend, built by a master in Utah, whose handmade rifles sold for several months of his Navy salary. It was a gift from his father after his first post-9/11 deployment and was one of his most prized possessions. He had planned to hunt more after he retired and entered the private sector. The rifle was chambered in .300 Winchester Magnum, and despite weighing far less than the sniper rifles he'd used overseas, was even more accurate. Instead of a traditional hunting scope, he had installed a Nightforce NXS 2.5 to 10x32mm, the same glass he used at work. The pack supported the rifle's fore end, and a small beanbag steadied the butt. Lying prone with the front and back of the rifle supported, he was able to hold the rifle as steady as any bench rest. As cars and trucks crested the hill to his west, he would dry fire at the driver's position of the windshield to get the timing right. The vacationers and local residents traveling this mountain road in the fall afternoon had no idea that they were in the crosshairs of one of the nation's deadliest warriors. Satisfied that his position was solid and that he'd have the right angle on the target, he retreated to the back of his mountain cubby and fired up his backpacking stove to heat water for his freeze-dried dinner. When the sun dropped below the skyline and the temperature fell by double digits, he crawled into his sleeping bag. He thought about his little girl, all blonde curls, tears welling up in her brave blue eyes as she saw Daddy off on his last deployment. 6 months away, and he would be home for good. Promise. He could still see her face pressed up against the airport glass for one last look as he boarded the plane. The hardest parts of a deployment were the first couple of weeks when you'd just left home, and the last couple when you started anticipating your return. That it was his last trip overseas made the light at the end of the tunnel brighter. Finally, the end of the train-deploy-train treadmill he and his SEAL brothers had been on for well over a decade. Curled up in his sleeping bag underneath a light show of stars that a city dweller couldn't comprehend, he slept sounder than he had in weeks. No waking up to realize that the nightmare was real. No reaching across the bed for a wife who wasn't there. No hearing the soft cries of a daughter who would never again crawl into his bed for protection from the boogeyman. He was already awake, staring at Orion, when his watch chirped at 0500. A swig from his water bottle and an energy bar would be his breakfast. He got into position behind his rifle and waited patiently for the sun to rise. Marcus Boykin was an early riser, as was nearly everyone in the financial sector. You were either up and at the table in his line of work, or you were asleep and on the menu. He looked at the weather forecast on his iPhone before slipping on a pair of designer jeans and some tan Italian loafers. He wore a Patagonia fleece over his pink Lacoste polo and put on a Yankees cap to hide his bald spot from the 20-something waitress he was currently trying to bed. To him, she wasn't Sarah with the degree in environmental engineering working to save up for her master's. She was the waitress. He'd been unsuccessful in getting into her pants so far, but she was broke and he was rich. One night, sooner or later, she'd get drunk and slip up and he'd be there to take advantage. Living this far out was part of the challenge, though he knew that to better his chances, he might have to get a condo in town at some point to help seal the deal. He grabbed his keys from the marble kitchen counter and pressed the remote start. It was freezing, and Boykin wanted the SUV nice and toasty with the heater running and the seats warmed by the time he made his to-go coffee and headed out. He opened his giant oak front door and took out his phone to tweet a photo of the orange glow of sunrise making its way over the mountain before he lost Wi-Fi coverage. The cell service was crap until you got to Jackson. He didn't really care about the view. In his mind, the sun would do the same thing tomorrow, but it would make his friends on both coasts jealous, a thought that he relished. As he climbed into the SUV and headed down the mountain road to US 89, his mind turned to thoughts of what he'd say to the waitress when he saw her. Combat is sensory overload, total chaos, especially if you're in command. The noise is deafening, both from the incoming and outgoing fire, while the overpressure of muzzle blasts and explosions rock your body down to its DNA. Men are yelling, not out of fear or panic, but to communicate above the roar. Tracers come in, rockets fly past. Dust from explosions and bullet strikes shroud your immediate world in a tactile cloud of dust. Radio traffic in your ears adds to the storm and demands a conscious response, which means one's actions in the moment must be subconscious. Identifying targets, firing weapons, changing magazines, all must happen automatically, as seamless as steering, shifting gears, and working the gas pedal of a car while talking on a cell phone. As a leader, you must rise even further above the storm and look beyond your own survival. You must direct the fire and movement of the entire element and resist the instinct to become just another gun in the fight. The whole thing is one tacky, psyche blur of constant decision-making. This was the opposite of chaos. Reese's senses registered nothing unnatural, just the calm of aspens in the breeze and the relaxing melody of wildlife easing into another day to a beautiful mountain sunrise. There was no radio, no one to communicate with, just the occasional hum of a car or pickup on the asphalt of the highway. The range to the dip in the road was exactly 625 yards, which meant that the bullet would drop 77 inches in its path from his barrel to the target. The rifle's scope was zeroed for 100 yards, so he would have to compensate for the difference. He came up 34 clicks, 3.4 mils, to make up for the drop. By dialing for the range, there would be no holdover. He could put the center of the reticle right on the target. Fight with every advantage you can get. The winds were light this early in the morning, which was a good thing. Wind calls were always tricky in the mountains, even for a pro. The Kestrel told him it was blowing 2 miles per hour from his left, a full-value wind that required 6 inches of hold. Since winds could shift at any moment, he used the mil dot reticle to hold off for the 0.3 mils. He heard the hum of the tires even before the blue halogen headlights haloed above the highway as the SUV climbed the rise. The silver Mercedes was unmistakably Boykin's. Thank God this guy didn't drive an F-150. The vehicle was coming straight at him, which meant no lead was required, but it was still hauling ass. He didn't have much time to admire the success of his planning. He tracked the target as it came down the hill, just as he'd done with the two other vehicles that had passed earlier that morning. He took a full breath, briefly rested at its peak, then exhaled to find his natural respiratory pause when his lungs had expended their air, steadying and focusing him for the task at hand. Doing so caused the movement of the scope's reticle to slow from an orbit to a small tremor. Even with a solid rest, it was never as steady as in the movies. The Mercedes hit the flat spot and appeared to stop for a second as he lost the perspective of its forward progress. He couldn't see the driver, not at this range and certainly not in this light. Holding just right of the windshield center, He slowly pressed the trigger. His ears heard the shot, but his brain barely registered the sound. The only sensation of recoil was the scope's image jolting into a blur as the rifle rocked skyward. Despite putting rounds into countless men in shitty corners of the world, his body still jolted into fight-or-flight mode, adrenaline surging into his body like a shot of heroin. He had killed plenty of men with his country's blessing in the past. But this time, pressing the trigger meant breaking the most sacred bond of society. He'd just committed murder. The monolithic bullet was a Barnes triple shock made from solid copper and scored inside the tiny hollow point to split into four petals upon impact, like a deadly flower. It was engineered to penetrate deeply on big game animals and worked so well that special operations troops adopted it for use during the global war on terror. When it hit the nearly vertical glass windshield of the Mercedes, the petals sheared off, leaving a cylinder of copper a third of an inch in diameter and still moving faster than most handgun rounds do at the muzzle. It struck Boykin on the bridge of his nose and angled downward slightly as it smashed cartilage, brain, and bone into jelly. It severed the first vertebra and exited the back of his neck, looking much like it did on the way in, before punching through the leather headrest and terminating its flight in the foam cushioning of the back seat. The Mercedes's cruise control was set on 60 miles per hour when its driver's brain ceased sending command signals to his body. His limbs quivered and jerked the way most animals and humans do when shot in the central nervous system, but the Teutonic engineering of the SUV kept the wheels traveling straight up the rise of the highway as if nothing had happened. When it roared past Reese's position, he thought for a second that he'd missed. As the vehicle crested the rise, having accelerated to make up for the steep grade, Boykin's lifeless body shifted forward in his restraint and caused the wheel to turn sharply to the left. The forward momentum, downward slope, and the SUV's high center of gravity created a snowball effect and caused the Mercedes to roll forward on its right front wheel, cartwheeling off the pavement and into the steep shoulder. The sound of rubber and steel meeting asphalt and rock were deafeningly loud, but only one man could hear it. Reese smiled for the first time in many months as he pulled a Ziploc bag from a pocket inside his jacket. Out of the bag came a folded-up crayon drawing with a list of names written on the back. With a tiny stub of a pencil, he crossed the first name off the list and returned it to its home against his chest.
Until the next time, take care out there, stay safe, be strong, keep fighting.